netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hi, and welcome to this week's FX Podcast. This one, a joint roundtable one from Seagraph 2011, joined by Mike and Ian. How's it going, guys?
Good, good. Nice to sit down, actually.
It is nice to sit down. It's been a really fun and eventful week here at Seagraph. Lots of great stuff to talk about, and Ian, great to have you here. What was one of the highlights of the show for you?
Well, I think, you know, it started off really well for us because we went and did some facility visits first when we came. And during the week, I sort of kept going to presentations from some of the visual effects companies, big ones like ILM, Imageworks, but also Digital Domain, Moving Picture. You know, they're the kind of things I like to see. They had great breakdowns. They're things you don't see anywhere else. That's what I really enjoyed.
Yeah, well, fantastic. And then, I don't know, from my standpoint, I really get a kick, and we tried to do as much as possible, end up going to sessions and so forth, and I think we had some really nice write-ups during the show. I think one of my favorites was had to be some of the lighting session that covered the Tokyo race sequence in Cars 2, where they did, you know, basically talked about a lot of the workarounds that they had to do to kind of get the rendering done within their budget and allotment.
It's funny when you hear Pixar having to go to such great lengths to get around computational problems. Like, if you had removed all the keywords like Cars 2 and Pixar, it could have been any facility anywhere in the world talking, and that facility might have said, you know, isn't it like we have a render farm like bloody, you know, Pixar does? But the complexity of that sequence, because of the number of lights, which was astonishing in Tokyo, meant that, you know, Pixar, with a theoretically, you know, the golden kind of excuse for buying processors and certainly able to license render licenses pretty well, I should imagine, was still hitting the walls really like 100 hours a frame, even on test frames, before they'd sort of solve some of the issues. So.
And Mike, you and I saw a really great short shading presentation from Pixar as well about how they did some of their shaders, like to do circular scratches on the cars.
That circular scratches thing was awesome. Oh, yeah. I mean, actually, it was really awesome in so many levels. It was awesome because it was like a phenomenon that I'd kind of noticed, that idea that when you look at a car, but actually you'd notice it on anything, like sometimes just metal, you get these kind of circular patterns around the specular highlight, which would lead you to think there were circular scratches, but in fact there aren't. It's just a random scratch pattern appearing circular. But yeah, and that's like one tiny detail of one tiny aspect of one tiny thing in one car. So,
yeah, another great session I thought was the Warner session, covering Captain America as well as Thor. But I thought what was neat about that is so often, and we've covered some of the stories before in the past on FX Guide, but it's not very often that we get to cover and talk about the work that Lola does, that you could actually see that in action, you know, because so much of what they do is cosmetic and fixes and so forth. And it was stunning, some of the stuff that they did for Skinny Steve. And I think, again, one of the great things about Seagraph is getting some insight that you might not ordinarily get sometimes in some of the other stories.
It's interesting that you've both focused on VFX films, and I've got to say that while that stuff is great, I'm not taking anything away from it, like, I can get some of that elsewhere. What I can't get is, like, some of the really super in-depth technical discussions. Like, I think there's...
Well, but, I mean, that's what I was just going to say. You can't get the kind of information that's there that they're talking about. Like, that idea that the Skinny Steve was talking about is that 240 hours in flame to do that scene. I mean, that's the stuff I hadn't heard of before, that kind of volume and what they're doing. And there's a certain candid openness that I think is exhibited here when you're attending that you don't get at other places.
Well, they showed a bunch of breakdowns on that Captain America and Thor panel that we would not have been able to see anywhere else.
And okay, so I totally agree with you, and I agree that you do see breakdowns that you don't see anywhere else. Yeah. And there seems to be some special rule about SIDGRAPH showing, right? Like you can show stuff that you absolutely could never show and couldn't even put on a DVD. No, I'm totally with you. But you can get at least some of that elsewhere, right? But, like, I mean, there are a few places that you can go for some of the sort of technical discussions. Like, if you go to some of the little tiny birds of a feather kind of geek out fests, which have got 20, 30 people in there, they may be, like, you know, six of the world's best experts on that subject, and there are only, you know, eight experts full stop. You know what I mean? And so those six getting together happens but once a year. So I wasn't sure. I maybe expressed that wrong. It's not that it's better or worse, just that just in addition to that, you get these really unique little clusters of incredible technical excellence. And it can be anything. Like, it could be GPUs, it could be color science, it could be, you know, apparently some of the dynamics and sim stuff that went on this week was really, really good, people were telling me.
Yeah.
I didn't get to that one.
I mean, I saw a few of those presentations where they were both sort of presented from university studies, more academic ones, but mm-hmm. then also being used in production, such as MPC's work on Kali, which they made for Sucker Punch, you know, and so it was great to see sort of this research being applied practically. And that's obviously what happens with SIGGRAPH, that some of the technical papers you end up seeing in the real world in films 2 or 3 years later, or, you know, whenever.
Yeah, we actually referenced that in one of the Adobe features we did earlier this year on Effects Guide TV, where literally their new warp stabilizer is something that directly came from here.
Yeah.
I mean, you can actually read the paper yourself. You can see the video and see that kind of stuff. So it does, and we've talked about that before, it does give you great insight. But there's, yeah, it's...
I was going to say, another good example of that for me is, so we've done some interviews here and looked at some stuff that's now just appearing in applications to do with deep compositing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, deep compositing is something we were covering on FX Guide like a year or two ago when it was just at a kind of research level. A few companies were obviously working on it, but their work hadn't yet come out. And so we then saw that work appearing in some films like Avatar and now Planet of the Apes, or Rise of the Planet of the Apes. And then literally right here at the show, releases from the Foundry and mm-hmm. RenderMan supporting deep color at a color and opacity level for high level, very deep and complex pipelines. And so that is evolving. Now, obviously, at that stage, I doubt there's anyone in commercials really using it for deep compositing right now, but that'll happen within the next, you know, few months to 6 months. And
I think especially when OpenEXR 2.0
yeah.
comes out and becomes solidified as a standard, and then
yep.
they can refine that. I think you're right. This can hit some traction. I actually found one of the interesting things at the Foundry Geek Fest interesting regarding the presentation that Frank Ruder did along with Peter Hillman, right, from Weta.
From Weta, yeah.
Was actually, and call me stupid, whatever, but it's like one of the things that didn't dawn on me is the ease at which it could ease some of the compositing tasks you had. You know, the idea of like setting up layers in depth
yep.
instead of having to stack all your layers and combine them. You still have to worry about that, but with deep compositing, some of that can happen semi-automatically
yeah.
for you. And,
which enables which is more
really,
scripting. Yeah.
yeah, which is really quite interesting. At least at the front end of setting up your scene, it does have the potential of making things easier. Of course.
But what's also good in that discussion on Rise of Planet of the Apes was how they were integrating it with live action.
Yeah.
Because I guess on Avatar, we were seeing it on fully CG-rendered environments, but when you get to Rise of Planet of the Apes, you're integrating it with live action photography, which inherently is 2D because obviously it was captured on a, you know, film plane or a digital plane.
Yeah, and just want to flag that we're going to have an FX Guide TV app coming out shortly or sometime in the next several weeks or months about that, dealing with Mike had an interview with Peter actually here at the show about it. Providing some more detail.
Yeah, and we also spoke to some guys producing some Nuke plugins that are mm-hmm. using that for reactive focusing kind of things. Imagine pulling focus when you're... Because, you know, like there is no out of focus and in focus, right? There's what we will accept as being in focus, gradually moving to a place that we say is soft and out of focus. But imagine you pulled focus in 3D or even comp stuff with deep compositing, you'd get lovely bokeh and stuff happening, but it all happened correctly through the Z-plane as it moved from front to back. As, oh man, that's going to be awesome. There's a film clip or a, you know, really good commercial to be had with somebody doing that, uh-huh. and that would just be rocking it.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens when that gets in the hands of people. So you've got the papers, you've got the talks from various studios about films and TV shows, you've got the Birds of a Feather, but you've also got the job market that you guys went to as well, which is a big aspect of the show.
I found that really busy, actually.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of full of students, and all the companies were very close together. Some companies actually had their booths as part of the exhibition, people like MPC and DD. Others were... Yeah,
I found MPC to be everywhere.
Yeah.
And I mean in that in a good way. Like they had some really good giveaways on there was like doing these bag giveaways, they were like cloth bag, goodie bag, really good things. But then they were like they were recruiting, they were at various talks, they were really active in, you know, doing stuff around the place. It just felt like, I don't know, whether it just MPC's on a roll, MPC's like just they just had a very strong presence in a professional way.
Well, obviously they've got a facility here in Vancouver as well now, you know, and about four or five around the world. So it makes a lot of sense. They've got over 1,000 people, I believe, you know.
So the Vancouver office, how big is that? Because I didn't think it was that big. But I guess that's what it is. It must be.
Well, I mean, they worked, I think, almost solely on Sucker Punch, you know, on their work for that. And,
okay.
And yeah, they've really contributed a lot of stuff.
That's actually something interesting. And I knew there were a lot of facilities up here, but I think it was a really smart idea to have it here because there is such a strong community here. It was the number of people who were located in Vancouver that I ran into that came up and recognized us either from FX PhD or FX Guide was interesting. I'm like, well, yeah, I mean, if you look at the number of facilities up here, it does make sense. But I think that was kind of an interesting aspect of one of the, you know, non-LA years versus somewhere outside of that, say, like in New Orleans or something like that. It, you know, it's kind of cool to have a healthy market.
I had a guy
and, you know, you got the
me.
Parties and visits and cocktail hours at those facilities as well. The hosts, I guess.
I had a guy come up to me, and he'd done some PhD courses. Then he went and enrolled in a university thing for like a year, and it was like a solid, you know, proper year course. And at the end of that, he was about to graduate. With that 2 months to spare, he rejoined PhD and brushed up on a bunch of stuff. And then when they went out in the market, he and his fellow graduates, he literally said, I had this like huge head start on them. And I would join with a few other graduates. And they were looking at me going like, when do we cover that? And he was like, well, I didn't. Because he'd kind of got the second lot of training through PhD. I never really thought of that, like having an addition. But he said he felt really good in those first few weeks and months of the new job because he felt like he had a bit like of an inside track to hit the ground running. And I love getting those kind of stories. Like, it's great.
Yeah, we mentioned the FX Guide TV episode this week as well, but we really appreciate hearing from people at the show and having people come up and tell us, you know, and talk to us and let us know their story. It's not a bother at all. We really actually enjoy hearing that. It's one of the reasons we like doing this so much, frankly.
Yeah, I should clarify that. I mean, we have a lot of people coming up saying they got jobs just because of PhD. I was just saying that was funny. I thought because they were doing a PhD in addition to a full-time course, and they thought that was even really good, so...
Yeah, that was great. Well, another aspect of the show, I think, is, well, much smaller than, say, NAB and IBC is the trade show and manufacturer. I think they kind of take second stage here, you know.
The manufacturers,
totally. Do. You know what I mean? It's more about the craft and paper. But they are here, and there's a lot of significant stuff going on at the show. And one of the big announcements, at least in our field, I think, was the new Houdini 12. I kept getting SMSs yesterday from the Houdini user group people of like taunting me, you really should be here, you got to check this out. And we were busy doing other stuff and working on the site and couldn't actually make it. But they really have an impressive release that's going to come out sometime, probably, you know, around the end of the year. It's going to go in beta in October. But just some phenomenal speed improvements. And we caught up with Jeff Wagner from Side Effects to kind of clue us in on what they've been working on in the last several months, last several years, as you'll hear, and find out what's been going on with that software.
So I heard great things about the user group meeting last night, but I think the biggest universal thing was how great Houdini 12 sounds. What was the concentration in the release?
The biggest focus for Houdini 12 is geometry rewrite, and essentially what that is our core technology at SideFX has always been SOPS, geometry. And that's what everybody uses. But with 12, or previous releases, we knew that the geometry engine was starting to get long in the tooth, and we needed to take advantage of the latest hardware, the multiple cores on both the CPUs and the GPUs, and it was becoming difficult for us to take advantage of that. We knew that already about 4, 5, 6 years ago. So we embarked on a big project, first small, and investigating writing thread-safe code and changing our internal code to take advantage of this. And about 2 or 3 years ago, we started on a real project to rewrite the geometry engine, and it's taken a long time, but what we have now is a fantastic architecture, and we haven't even ourselves been able to take real advantage of it, and the numbers that we're getting from just the small improvements that we've made in taking advantage of this new architecture is quite exciting.
Well, let's take a minute just to backtrack a little bit, and I'm sure that some of these issues in the underlying core weren't really apparent until you start looking at the modern machines, where it's really not uncommon to have 16 or more cores in a device. And isn't that where it becomes apparent where the stuff is kind of falling short in what people expect today?
Oh, absolutely. It's no mystery that when you open up your performance monitor and you're running Houdini and you're doing anything in SOPs, you're really only using one core. And our users say that you're only using one core, and other applications are starting to do a bit of job of that, and they're saying, you know, side effects, you got to take advantage of the other cores. So that was, yeah, definitely, that was a lot of the you know, to get it to go and get it processing.
And it's got to be a little bit apprehensive when what you're doing is not releasing these brand new glorious creative features or something like that, but actually getting into making things better from an architecture standpoint. But I think it kind of showed that you were right in making that decision, the reaction last night.
Oh, absolutely. Everybody uses a particular part of the architecture, which is groups and geometry. And we've always paid a big penalty for that with the old architecture. With the new architecture, it's seamless. So I can see massive amounts of data being pushed through this application. And hopefully it'll help us make inroads into the more back-end environment sets, props, and lighting parts of pipelines as well. So, and branching out beyond what we are traditionally known for, which is visual effects.
And just to be clear, because we haven't talked about specific numbers, but we're talking some significant facts and significant speed-ups in what you're doing. Can you kind of give us some insight into the type of speed-ups you've seen in various operations in the software?
Sure. Just doing simple transforms of geometry, we're seeing at least a 2 to 3 times increase in performance. And just the general memory consumption, just loading geometry in, we're seeing fairly significant improvements. But as you add more operators to the original geometry, you do transforms, you cut geometry, you add geometry, we're seeing performance increases anywhere from 10 to 100 and with a lot of groups, 1,000 times. 1,000 times faster with groups. Yes, it's very significant. It showed you the overhead that groups had in the old architecture, and I just want to say, because of that, we're going to release on this Friday Houdini 11.1, and that will be the bridge, because the geometry data formats have changed so much. We expect people to start using Houdini 12 in production, and we know that Houdini 11 is still it's stable, it's well known, so we have to make sure that path goes back. So Houdini 11.1 is going to be the bridge towards Houdini 12.
So what kind of timetable are you expecting that to getting a release out? Is it kind of up in the air, or what's your plan or thoughts regarding that?
Oh, SideFX has always had a very interesting release schedule. We have the daily builds, obviously, and I shouldn't say this, but Houdini's already been used in 12, has been used in by a few early testers who just wanted a piece of the functionality. We are going into beta in mid-October. And essentially what that is stage. So we'll add a few customers at first, and then as the weeks progress, we add more and more and more until essentially it's a release. And when the stability is there and all the programmers have solved all the release blockers, we just sort of draw a line in the sand and we release. But it's not uncommon for late parts of the beta for people to start really engaging the software when it gets to a stability point. I would be very optimistic if I'd said the release would be in December, but more realistically, it's going to be in the first quarter of 2012. So we're going to see the release.
Is waiting some time to actually take a step back, has waiting some of the time to make these improvements actually helped you? Because there have really been some astounding improvements, especially in GPU-type operations that have happened in the last couple of years. I mean, it's actually kind of served you well that you've been able to kind of leap directly into that?
Absolutely. I'm not sure if this is, but I think we're the first vendor to actually have GPU accelerated solvers in that's going to be in a shipping product. Yeah, it's really helped us in waiting. The new graphics cards, for instance, from NVIDIA and ATI have really come along. For instance, the Fermi cards at NVIDIA, perfect timing for us, because it now allows users to finally take advantage of these high-end graphics cards in an off-the-shelf software and really reduce production times. For instance, in our smoke fluid solver in Houdini 12, even just without the GPU, just using the CPU, it's 10 to 15 times faster. And when you go to the GPU, 100 times faster than what we saw in Houdini 11. And that means real-time fluid feedback, and it's significant for our users, yeah.
I think always a big concern on users when you start talking about GPU is supporting GPUs, whether you're GPU agnostic, do you rely on certain vendors? Philosophically, where do you guys kind of stand regarding that?
Oh, great question. OpenCL has been our we looked at, we sort of settled on OpenCL. for two reasons. One, it's an open language. It's very accessible. And the second, it also has a really cool fallback. So if you, for instance, are doing a 300-cubed volume, I can do that fairly successfully on even a consumer-level graphics card. But if you want to go to 500, 600K, we actually can now fall back with the exact same solver on the CPU. And that's the sort of advantage that OpenCL gives you. Obviously, there's CUDA, and we've investigated that as well. And if that makes sense to use in a certain particular application, I don't see us not doing it. So we're very familiar with both. But OpenCL does offer that ability to fall back. One of the issues with OpenCL, though, is its cross-platform support. And that's sort of a bit of an overhead for us. For instance, Windows is a bit of a different interface than Linux and the Mac. But that's something that we're going to take on and move forward. We see this as a way forward for sure.
And also within the architecture of GPUs, are there specific things you need to worry about in dealing with not just bandwidth to the graphics card, but also memory issues and things like that? Has that been any kind of hitch in what you're doing?
Oh, absolutely. As I said, for instance, with fluids, the limit that you can fit on the card with about three or four fields to solve it is about 300, 320 cube. A Fermi card, obviously, you can go a lot further with that, but then it's currently quite expensive. Probably not the case in a year or two from now. But getting massive simulation data sets on a GPU at this point in time is challenging at best. But if you're doing smaller things like doing smaller fluids or doing simple, we're investigating it for other parts of Houdini as well that have more, less data requirements, they would be perfect for the graphics card. And the viewport, for instance, doing viewport instancing, we're looking at all of those sorts of things that our customers have to write custom tools for right now. We really would like to be in a position to take advantage of that and give them off-the-shelf tools to take full advantage of the graphics card for things they're having to still write custom code for.
Well, thanks so much for taking time to talk to us. I appreciate it.
Actually, John, you don't even if you know this, but you know, I used to use, well, not directly, I guess, but Houdini a lot in its earlier earlier in its life.
Oh, really?
For broadcast design, yeah. When I was doing station IDs, when I came back from living in Hollywood, and I was doing, like, network stuff, that was all done in the previous version of what is now Houdini.
Well, that's impressive.
But it was a bit slower then.
It was a bit slower, and I think, obviously, from the conversation you get, there's a speed up. I just want to throw some numbers out there, which are pretty stunning, I think.
Have you actually got some stats on
just,
it?
Yeah, and these are just, this is beta software, not optimized or whatever. But if you take a look at cloth solver, comparisons show 150 times speed improvement in the cloth
solver. Did you say 150?
150 times.
Okay.
Render instancing is another example. A rendering of 10,000 instances takes only about 2.8 seconds in Houdini 12. Compared to 380 seconds in Houdini 11.
Wow.
So we're talking some significant scale of speed from then. Totally, and you know, as we talked, they totally reworked.
Somebody said to me, I think it was you, Ian, that they're seeing good numbers in particles and sims and stuff as well. Have you got anything on that? Do you have anything on the?
Yeah, actually, you know what? On a 24 gig machine, Houdini 11 was able to create about 7 million points in a flipped fluid sim. In Houdini 12, 77 million.
Okay, that is literally an order of magnitude. Yeah.
Yeah, so quite impressive. And I think, you know, as a software manufacturer, you'd be kind of hesitant not putting any GWS features into it and just stick to rewriting and making it run faster. But also for things like this, that's a huge change.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, that's like, literally, like, imagine it was like 10 minutes to do something versus 110 minutes to do something. Like, that's, you know, okay, I can do something versus a couple of hours even to see if it's going to work. Yeah, wow.
Well, let's just say I think a lot of people will be itching to get their hands on the beta at this point.
Actually, I think you joked about this before, but there was a real buzz around Houdini that was like more noticeable around the Houdini stuff than almost any other announcement here. Do you know what I mean? Like there was a lot more Twitter traffic, a lot more, hey, did you see, you know, on the escalator kind of buzz around Houdini, I think, than almost any other product.
Yeah, and I'm really happy. I mean, at FXBC, we're starting to really work closely with them in our curriculum. We have a new fluid effects-based course, water effects system at FXBC, and we're hopefully going to have more and more in the future. Because if you go to their website, they have a listing of articles about Houdini. Their publications that have Houdini, it's like FX Guide, FX Guide, FX Guide, FX Guide. So it's really a nice fit with our audience, I think.
Hey, and one of the things I noticed is there seemed to be less computational photography papers here. Like in past years, I've ranted and raved about how great the computational photography stuff is. Do you think that just was like, I don't know, unfashionable this year, or it was had moved on, or because last year?
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, there's much less of that. Much less also motion capture stages on the trade show board.
But you know what was here? Sorry.
Yeah. No, go ahead.
So what was here was, you know, the Spheron HDR camera mm-hmm. now doing 24 stops capture. Now, if you were tracking with us in New Orleans, we did this camera's introduction, mm-hmm. but they never actually got to switch it on because the parts that were meant to be coming of the prototype were caught in customs. We then followed up and got to them in L.A., last year, where they had the camera but didn't want to talk about it, and I was like, but you've got a booth, and they were like, no, we just wanted you to talk to researchers because it's not, you know, it was like, exactly. And at one point they had Nuka with a file, and I like went forward to start playing with it, and they literally shut the laptop and nearly took my finger off and like, no. And I was like, okay. But this year they were incredibly friendly to see me. I don't know, maybe somebody had said that I wasn't actually a complete dick, I don't know, but they had footage, they had a camera running live, they were running through the frames. It's still, I would describe as very raw. Like, mm-hmm. I could see some noise at one end of the 24 frames that I think you'd expect to see, but also I'm sure you could have killed with any kind of signal noise processing stuff. So it was like, it's still, it's not like completely embedded, production ready. And it is a bit of a specialist camera. It's not like it's got an eyepiece on it or a viewfinder or anything. But it's fully running, it's fully working.
They have used it in some productions, haven't they?
They're just starting to. They've done some tests. I'm not know that they've used the other Spheron camera, which is the 360 degree scanning offset one, in, and that's now standard in the Sony pipeline, and that was used on Smurfs.
Right.
But and then they were so friendly this year. I mean, really super friendly. And they started telling me about all the things they're going to do next year, which I can't tell you about. But trust me, they're really, really interesting. So even though it's taken a couple of years to get to market, this camera, especially for kind of what you might call the more scientific end of image capture on set and stuff, next year, you wait, the stuff they're going to come out with is just going to be awesome. But yeah, so I was glad to see the Spheron guys back.
Yeah, and speaking of cameras, one thing I was hoping to see here and didn't was like some cool breakthrough in actual showing of a really high-resolution panoptic camera.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Of some
like,
kind, you know?
Yeah,
I mean, I was just kind of like, I was holding that. I hadn't heard anything beforehand. Yeah. There's the guys, the researchers from Stanford, who had actually done some of the original research and started their company, got a lot of venture funding. I don't know. I just had this vision that we'd have like four or five of them on the trade show floor that we could check out.
Yeah, I would have thought so, too.
And, of course, we're talking about the cameras that have multiple lenses on them and allow you to selectively focus and change your depth of field or shoot stereoscopic within a single camera. But maybe that's next year, I guess. Maybe the technology is quite there. I actually thought it was a little further off. So when those guys announced that they were going to ship a camera, I thought, okay. But I was hoping to see something regarding that here, especially after seeing that last year.
Speaking of other stuff that came back, which we covered a bit in FX Guide TV, but the Olympic stuff was mm-hmm. back. So mm-hmm. that's the baked geometry format as a standard now released 1.0. And I've got to say, like, OpenEXR is such a success story. And then if Olympic can take off, and then there are other things like the OpenColor.io, which we're doing in background fundamentals this term, these open standards from the big houses really hold a lot of potential for allowing, I don't know, just a heck of a lot better workflow. Because I mean, what production these days, I mean, Ian, we do stories all the time. They're like 7-8 facilities that worked on a film.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, it seems like more recently, especially in London, but I think it's happening in the US as well, that these facilities are cooperating more, working, they have to. They're working on the same film, but they're also working on the same shots and literally sharing assets. And
I have to say that. I think that's also why it's happening. But you mentioned as well, you have people like Rob at Sony, Rob Bredow at Sony, but then you also have ILM, and you have Disney. You know, Dan Candela is leading their efforts down there. If you're getting those main facilities together, you know, they can kind of help push that through, I think, because, you know, they want to make sure that you're supported.
Like ILM gave processing technology mm-hmm. to the Academy for the IIF stuff, the ACES stuff, and that's in addition to, of course, OpenEXR and OpenEXR 2 and the stuff with Olympic. So we need the London houses to step up. The London houses to step up and start open standard stuff. What should we pick? What do we want the London houses to come through on? Open standards on something. Hey, what was that? You spoke to some of the other 3D companies here, right? Because you mentioned...
I thought one thing that was interesting I wanted to get through... we get in a bit of a motion graphics vein here for a bit, because I know a lot of you listening, work on TV commercials, do motion graphics. And, of course, Maxon is one of the key ones. If you're designing 3D and motion graphics applications, they just announced their new release that's going to be coming out with a lot of great new features. But I thought it would be interesting to kind of give a bit of perspective of kind of the uptake and the people, number of people who are using Cinema 4D, because it's really obviously been really huge in motion graphics in the past, but I think you're seeing it being accepted more broadly in the market, and I think that it really shows in the kind of sales numbers that they've gotten at the company. And I caught up with Paul Babb, who actually leads the North and South American aspects of Maxon, and kind of got an update, and he shared some numbers with me at NAB, and I kind of wanted to hit him up again here and see if they're still on that roll. And yes, they are. You related a story, or related some facts at NAB at your astounding growth, which were just jaw-dropping. Can you kind of walk us through that?
Yeah, I don't have the numbers in front of me for the rest of the world, so I only know mine. But from 2009 to 2010, or our 2010 was 47% over our 2009. Now, 2009 was a down year for everybody to a certain point, but we had about 5% growth that for 2009. So even on a year where we probably should have gone backwards, we actually were still going forwards. And then 2010, we had 47% growth over 2009, and so far this year we're over 50% over 2010. So our growth is crazy right now.
And just to reiterate, this is for the United States. This is not like you're not talking about company-wide getting into China, getting into India, anything like that.
No, this is North and South. My territory is North and South America. But Maxon's growth is equally impressive, I think. I think combined worldwide or global growth, I think it's still well into the 30%.
Now, some of that growth, I find it interesting, or there's a TV commercial that I've seen in the past, and the guys start a website, and they see one order come in, they see two orders, and then ding, 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 and they start freaking out. What was that process? Was there any kind of ramping up? Was it almost too much of a good thing, or how'd that impact things?
Well, growing pains is something that I'm dealing with, but it's more that, you know, we're trying to maintain the quality of the service and the things that we do, so we're all putting a little more work into it than we've had in the past, but... we will be beefing up a little bit. We're going to put in some staff and to give everybody a little bit of a break, type of thing. But no, it wasn't really that as much as it was. I think the motion graphics industry is growing just as much as we're growing. I mean, there's more motion graphics being done. Even just watching television, the quality of the commercials, the quality of the station IDs, the interstitials, all the little flying graphics flying around, there's just so much more motion graphics being done. And that's trickling into, you know, corporate presentations. And then you're talking about the visualizers too, people who are doing, product visualization or those types of things. So I think the industry is growing as much as we are, but...
Well, I think it's also interesting, though, and obviously you do have strength in motion graphics, but in the last several releases, there seems to be also an emphasis or a new thing in dealing with, one could consider, visual effects type problems solving, projection mapping, physical cameras, rendering improvements. Is that something that's led by that, or is that just something that actually also does have great benefits when dealing with motion graphics?
I think it's more the demand in those industries as well. We definitely had a great relationship with Sony and the freelance matte environment creators out there, and so those tools were improved based on their requests. And as those tools became more accessible to everybody else, the requests for making it easier and more different types of image quality and things like that, definitely see those. And we are seeing more our product being used more and more in the visual effects industry, mainly because there are a lot of smaller shops popping up. Cinema is definitely an attractive product to the small and medium sized shops. It's easier to pick up. It's easier to learn. If you're the type of studio that's been predominantly doing After Effects types of effects and 2D, we're a great transition into 3D because it makes a lot of sense to those folks. But we are seeing a lot of more visual effects. Actually, one of our demo artists, David Lewandowski, he's showing a lot of his Tron work, and he's adamant during his presentation. We thought it was kind of funny. He was adamant in his presentation that people should know that of the top visual effects movies that were done this year. Cinema was used in all of them. And he says that about three times during his presentation. He almost takes more of an affront to it than we do, that cinema doesn't get the same kind of credit as other packages do. But we've said it for years. We're another paintbrush in the tool set. And nobody uses just one paintbrush. So,
is there danger of losing focus maybe on that? I mean, you could become, use the jack of all trades, master of none kind of line. I mean, is that something that actually you have discussions in-house about to make sure that you don't water down everything else?
Well, we've always been a good all-around 3D package. Yeah, cinema's always been a great all-around 3D package. I think that artistry is artistry. You wouldn't tell, people who have, again, back to the paintbrush metaphor, you wouldn't tell a paintbrush guy that, be careful, you don't want to, you want to make sure that brush works for this type of art, not that type of art. I think you make the best paintbrush you can, and it can be used in all situations. But one of the things I mentioned during this meeting, too, was a lot of the character tools came out of our motion graphics guys who were saying, we'd like to do a bit more character stuff, but it's so complex. So they came up with this great character object and made it easy for motion graphic guys to do it. So I think the artists are graduating over to different areas as well. I mean, we've got guys who do motion graphics, medical illustration, visual effects, and do matte paintings. I mean, it's the artistry that's going on.
It seems like the features you're adding serve what you're doing. The motion graphics, the type of things you're adding really do that. And on top of that, I think it is, you mentioned the approachability of your software. You're walking a really good line between being approachable but leaving enough high-end features that people can take it and do what they want at higher levels. Well,
you have to. Yeah. You have to, because...
Well, no, I mean, the character rigging is a good example of something that, frankly, is easier than I've seen in other 3D products, right? I mean, that makes it really easy to do, but at the same time, you do have the flexibility to do higher end or more difficult things with it.
Well, you do. I focused on the ease of use because we want to make it as approachable as possible to everybody so people can go, wow, I could do it. However, there are character features in there that other 3D packages don't have. The name ones, that there are features that we've seen on other 3D forums saying, geez, I wish they had this feature, and we have those features. So there's a capability there. And they didn't want to just, we're not trying to, duplicate what other people are doing. We're trying to make it as easy as possible for anybody to do it and have that same high-end capability because, okay, you can rig a character, you can make them walk, but if it doesn't look any good, nobody's going to want to use it, because those same artists who want it to be easy to use still want it to be pretty in the end. So all those rendering features, a lot of the rendering features are very visual effects, high-end rendering features, all the work that they did with the physical camera and those types of things. That's stuff that mostly the visual effects guys have been asking for.
I have to say that I think that I would be the first to confess I was a bit dismissive back in the day that they would be this successful, and I'm here happily eating my words.
Well, I talked to Paul about this, and I would say maybe one of those reasons, and justifiably so, it was really targeted in motion graphics. If you think in their more recent releases, they've added things like projections. I mean, from a visual effects standpoint, you're not going to be using that application as much if you don't have projections.
No.
They're just now introducing physical cameras with true depth of field, real motion blur based upon. So they're adding more and more physical world type stuff, so you can actually see it happening. And frankly, their integration with After Effects has always been one of the strong selling points. I think it's a really interesting application because what they're doing is they're making certain operations in 3D, I think, more accessible to users and especially designers. And I don't want to say they're dumbing it down, but I think they're doing some unique and interesting things from the UI, like their new character development. You can auto-build your rigs for rigging a character for animation, but you can still do it the old school way.
Oh, no. It's just funny because we were talking to Gen Arts about their roadmap looking forward.
Yeah.
And in particular, the new Sapphire that's going to be coming out hopefully soon. Mm-hmm. And we got a sneak peek at that. We can't show you any pictures, but it was funny because we were looking at lens flares, and they've got this incredibly impressive lens flare editor. But in the process of looking at this lens flare editor, the guy who was demoing this to me said, of course, you see lens flares as needing to be camera accurate, but for a lot of graphic designers, they're just an element. It doesn't matter whether they're doing the right thing or not, as long as they just look funky. And I was like, okay.
Yes, so true.
Well, because, I want a lens flare to pivot through the center of screen, right? Like, because I know it to be a coding pivot point. And he's like, yeah, but... you don't if you're a graphic designer.
Well, but I do have to say it was really cool. I'm a big fan of Andrew Kramer's Pro Lens Flares that he sells that go in After Effects. Yeah. And I'll leave the facility unnamed, but actually saw it being used at one of those facilities on effects, which was kind of cool. So it's a really great lens for a plug-in. It does try to recreate natural stuff, but yeah, your point is very much a good one, I think, from that realm.
I think
one thing I also want to bring up, related, we talk motion graphics design, After Effects, there would be what would you call a shot fired across the bow of Cinema 4D with the new 3ds Max release related to that, because one of the big features that they talked about in this release was a new capability of interacting with After Effects. And just in speaking with them, they really see 3D Max with the potential of actually being a really good, solid motion graphics type application feeding After Effects. So we actually caught up with a longtime friend of FXPhD, basically the guy who helped us out from Term 1 doing 3ds Max courses, Gary Davis, who now works for Autodesk, and kind of got the lowdown on what they've been doing to actually kind of literally and figuratively bridge the gap to After Effects.
Okay, so there's been a lot of talk about this new After Effects bridge, so to speak, or talking After Effects from 3ds Max, but actually there's some core changes that actually enable that. So why don't we start with the building blocks of what that is?
Yeah, so the new feature is called State Sets, one of the new features that we're kind of focusing on this discussion, but State Sets is part of this subscription advantage pack. And one of the things that it can do is these render passes. It's actually much more than just render passes, but as it's being touted, you know, initially is this render pass manager. But essentially what you've got is, I like to consider the base scene in 3ds Max is what I call the base state. And then what state sets do is record as many sets of changes to that base state, which gets a little confusing at first, but so if you just keep thinking about this base state, you can still make changes to that base state, but what you're doing in state sets is recording changes to, or deltas, if you want to think of it that way, to the base state. So, for example, I might have a base state set up, and it's kind of finished. It doesn't have to be finished, but it's kind of like almost ready to render. And then what I'll do is say, you know, I might be set up for speed's sake to use the scanline renderer and set up my specular and diffuse and ambient, or sorry, scanline renderer doesn't do ambient occlusion. That's where I'm headed here. So you could set it up, render elements that scanline supports, and then stop recording that state set. Then you create a second state set called ambient occlusion, and then hit record, and then go change your renderer to mental ray. You change your environment and all the stuff that you would do to set up an ambient occlusion sort of grayscale render, and then you stop recording that state set. Now, one of the things, and I'll kind of backpedal there, an interesting fact about state sets is they're not tied to any particular renderer. So this is something that we're really, it's not getting a lot of, I don't know, press, but maybe you need to be a nerd to understand what that means. Mental Ray, V-Ray, Brazil, Final Render, Maxwell, Scanline, Quicksilver, iRay, it does not matter what you're using, and you can mix and match these. So whereas previously workflows would very commonly have multiple files on your hard drive, you know, I have a max file called Beauty Pass and a max file called Mental Ray Ambient Occlusion. And if I screw up or I make a change or I need to move the car over 2 feet, I have to make that exact change in multiple files. Well, that is no longer, you'll never have to do that ever again. So it's a pretty powerful thing. Now, having said all that, so we hit render and all this wonderful frames come out. Part two to this equation is this link to After Effects. Again, our marketing is saying After Effects, and we're really proud to be working with Adobe on this link to After Effects. But what's really happening under the hood is Max is writing out a file to disk, which is XML-based. It's an SOF, which is our own kind of file format. But it's an XML-based file. So phase one of this is a hook to After Effects, which, for obvious reasons, it's a big, popular product that's out there. You've probably heard of it. So we've got a live link between 3ds Max and After Effects that's basically this file on disk. And so Max writes it out. After Effects opens up this file using a plugin developed by Autodesk. And then you can basically send over lights, cameras, null objects, let me think what else, footage, which is obviously your render passes, and then 3D image planes or solids, as they're called in After Effects. So more to that's kind of interesting is that it's bidirectional. You're not just pushing things from Max to After Effects. I could go in and move a light in After Effects and move a solid layer down and back in Z-Space or Y. I don't know which is what they call what over there. But you could move it around and then hit an update button, and those changes will be pushed back to 3ds Max. So It's a very exciting solution. And actually, another thing they're really not talking about is there's also ties to Photoshop. So you can, if you're doing print work or high-res still work, all of this workflow with state sets that I described is still the case, but then instead of creating an After Effects link, you can just build a PSD out of all of your render passes. So this is phase one, like we say. It's big hooks to Adobe, but that's not exclusive to that pipeline.
Right. So, I mean, if you were versed in coding or something like that, it's an XML file. Conceivably, you could get in some other software application.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, you'd have to do that coding yourself, but you could get it in, say, a Nuke or Flame or something.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I'm not a programmer, but I've done compositing enough to, you know, if you open this up in a text editor, it's just a file on disk, and you open it up, and it's pretty much just describing what layer order, what transfer mode to use, what opacity, and it also supports, interestingly, some basic functions like a color correction, you know, hue shift and that kind of thing. Nothing, you're not going to be doing wild compositing trees in Max or 3ds Max, but you can basically set up a pre-comp and send that across. So yeah, the XML file is going to be the door to other packages. I'll be vague there, but it's the writing is on the wall that this, we didn't just tie this to one.
Gary D, he is the man. It's funny, actually. Yeah. The thing is, I got to tell you, I'm sorry. Until it's on a Mac, I'm not really gonna.
Funny. You should mention that because
they haven't released it on the Mac, have they?
They have not released on Mac, but there was a job posting on the Autodesk website for a 3D Max OS X developer.
Oh, really? Are you kidding?
Yeah, leaked out. Actually leaked out in this week, and people were posting link to the job posting. I think multiple job postings, if I'm correct. And of course, I asked them about it, and you know, Ken, who's leading the development, is like, "Well, you know what? We're exploring it." I'm like, well, "Okay, you're posting for it.
You're hiring for it.
You're hiring for it."
Hey, talking about firing shots across the bow. So you know, at the Geek Fest you mentioned earlier, which is really effectively the Foundry user group meeting, they flagged the fact that they have a lot of technology for doing painting and layering for texturing, and then they went, "We could just use the painting and layering capabilities to make a high-end professional paint program that handles really large textures and would be used for more general purposes."
Yeah, I like Jack Reesley, who's a product manager, goes, you know, "I think we've got the whole painting on 3D models thing down pretty well. I think maybe the next thing we'd approach was painting on 2D planes."
Actually, he went further. Remember, he actually said, I think we've tackled the easy stuff of painting interactively on 3D models that are studio whatever. Yeah. Now we're going to tackle the hard things, flat 2D.
Yeah. But hey, you know, an HDR painting program, you know, layer based.
Seriously, how many copies would they sell? Huge amount, right?
Yeah.
But it wouldn't ever wipe out Photoshop because Adobe sells gazillions of those.
Right. It's.
But the Foundry wouldn't have to sell a gazillion for it still to be the number one Foundry selling product ever. Because, you know what I mean, like, seriously, wouldn't almost every artist get a high-end... I mean, I know I would. I would.
And
rid of Photoshop. I'd
just
have it in addition.
And even the sarcastic comment from Jack. I mean, he's right, though. It probably would not be that much to actually implement some of the layered painting techniques, but then just simply apply them with 2D plane versus 3D. Probably wouldn't be that much of a development process either. So I think it'd be interesting to see if that happens in the future.
Okay, but I did wind up somebody from the Foundry about that later, and that is not about to be released.
No. Well, yeah, that's
point blank
way past 2.0,
yeah,
even
not,
what they were talking
like
about.
Next second. But having said that, they were quite open about the fact that they were going to be exploring it. So I don't know that Adobe would be expecting their stock price to tank, but I definitely think that it wouldn't hurt if you had a Foundry sales rep nearby to say, "Hey, I'd be really interested in that product if it comes out."
Yeah, please, just no text tool in it. That's all I ask. Let's keep away from that. So what else we got? Actually, I caught up also, one thing just went interesting relating to 3D, so we've been talking about that as well, is catching up with Chris Bond from Thinkbox Software, who's really spent quite an active year, the first year that they've been in business developing products. And, of course, Krakatoa, people use a big fan of it, but that's, of course, very tightly integrated with 3ds Max.
I love Krakatoa.
Yeah, it's really impressive. And so they've introduced a new version of that, and they're actually breaking it up into two products, one that's still going to be basically your Max version, but then in a more extensible one that can actually be fed from any 3D application. So instead of building a renderer for a specific app, building one for Maya, you know, building one for whatever, anything else, they've decided to create a standalone renderer
that then can be fed from a 3D application. And we caught up with Chris earlier in the week to find out more about it. Well, one of the big things is, though, that Krakatoa originally developed formats.
Right.
It's a background, but I'm sure people have been clamoring probably for a while about getting that.
Yeah.
It was
interesting because we had a lot of requests. I mean, every month somebody would say, we want Krakatoa poured to my favorite product. So,
Facts. And
we had a lot of internal discussion about how do we deal with, there's clients who want Krakatoa SR, there's clients who want, or sorry, Krakatoa for Soft Image, there's clients who want it for Houdini, there's clients who want it for Maya, people who want it for Nuke. And so we decided rather than trying to port Krakatoa to all of them, what we would do is do a standalone version of Krakatoa. So Krakatoa standalone version 1, which we're calling 2, so it's in mm-hmm. sync because they're right. the same feature set, is a standalone particle rendering toolkit for which handles Krakatoa. And essentially, to make you understand, it's not there's no interface at this point. There's mm-hmm. no application. It's just the core rendering engine for Krakatoa. We're supporting rib style input, so it's very easy to get data like lights and cameras out of Maya, Soft, Nuke, mm-hmm. any of those applications. And we'll be shipping demonstrable versions okay. of how to get that data out. And it supports particle data and object data, so you can take OBJs or our XMesh format and use that as mat objects or as objects to emit particles or whatever within the particle system. Like, for example, you can pass it splines
right.
and create hair directly in the standalone.
Okay.
And then you can generate particle data from anything and push that in and render it with Krakatoa. So there's already PRT particle exporters that people have written mm-hmm. to get into Krakatoa for Houdini and Soft Image and Maya and so forth. And what we'll do is make sure they're all up to snuff with our new, that's one thing I forgot to mention, our new PRT format, which loads particle data sets like 10 times faster okay. than the previous one, which is part of Krakatoa SR2. So basically what it means is that anybody who could generate particles will be able to render their particles to Krakatoa SR. It supports Linux, Windows, Mac OS X is coming soon. It's got... we'll be able to get it out of Maya, Houdini, Soft Image,
right.
Nuke, Digital Fusion, anything that has particles, we'll be able to use Krakatoa.
There's a reason for doing it standalone that way, because I can imagine it's difficult to create a separate thing for every single product
that's out right.
there.
That's right, yeah. And what we'll do is as it comes out, our focus is ensuring that it's got the same feature set in terms of rendering with Krakatoa MX so that they're cross-compatible and that you'll be able to, if you need to do something more advanced, you could boot up Max and do something. But the goal is ultimately, I want to be able to ensure that the Houdini artists, the Maya artists get the tools, the Soft Image guys can use ICE to get the particles exactly they want and then get that unique Krakatoa look with their tools that they use.
Well, before we close out, I just want to kind of do a recap on how the last year's been and everything. I mean, his, getting this going, everything up to going, how's stuff working out?
Well, great. I mean, it's different. I mean, before I've always been involved in production mm-hmm. and then software and R&D has kind of been this sideline. We've sold some products and now software's the focus. And so I don't know if it's clear to everyone. It feels like we're getting technology out faster. We started in October, 23rd was our official launch date of ThinkBox software, and we very quickly launched Frost, Krakatoa 2 now, Deadline 5 now, and Deadline 5.1 is an update, and then we have Fathom and XMesh that are getting close to test. We've got them in alpha already, XMesh is in beta. So, by the end of the year, I hope that our product line will be like 5 products, and by next year we'll be adding a few more. So we're offering all this technology that before we kept internally because we said this is a production advantage for us to have these tools and do things that are unique. And now it's like, well, let's make sure everybody succeeds. Let's take our pipeline experience and integrate all of those things into our products. And let's take all of these tools that we had. And so there's just going to be more and new technology coming out. So we're excited, and it's going really well. And I hope that people like it.
Yeah, no, it's great. And I've talked to a lot of people, too. You're still maintaining that connection to production because I've actually talked to several people.
Yeah.
And that you are really critically interested in hearing what your users and everything are still using. It's not like you're abandoning that in any way.
No. I mean, to be precise, the group of us all sat down and we said, bothers us about other software companies, and we wanted to we created our mission statement, and the primary goal was support and integration for our clients. And so the professional services offering is putting that on paper and saying we're available to customize or build technology and products for your show. It's one of the things we had a lot of fun on movies. You know, we developed, you know, Kryptonite Growth on Superman. We developed, you know, the rendering. We did rendering on movies like Stay and all these feature films, G.I. Joe. We created the particle look. And we just feel like, you know, with these shows and these, it's, we would love to participate and do that with other people. And so, you know, we just did it recently with Blur. Right. And we're happy to, you know, sign NDAs, work with people really closely to show off the technology. But the key for our company is we want to make sure that we support them. And so, you know, the developers are doing a lot of the support because they like to and they choose to. We have a support team. We spend a lot of time on the forums. I spend time on there. We want to make sure that people are happy with the product, that they like it. And if they have problems, they come to us. We can help solve them because, you know, I have no interest in... A lot of companies say this, like, they buy the software and they don't expect that they can actually get support.
Right.
And they get surprised when we're like, here, and here's a new build or a patch or a solution for you. And my goal is that, you know, it's like visual effects. When I was in visual effects, all we want to do is make our clients happy and iterate with them. And I feel like we're treating the software industry similarly. So
makes a lot of sense because of your background.
Exactly.
Well, thanks for taking the time to talk to us. I appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
So, Ian, John's making our manhood look cheap because it seems like all the interviews here at SIDGRAPH will be done by John Montgomery. But I think you and I have actually done some work since we've been here.
Yes, we've done a lot. You've done a lot of video interviews. I've been able to sit down with a bunch of cool people. One of them was...
Is it not enough that every interview on this podcast looks like we've done no work? We came and just...
Oh, look at the homepage.
hung out and drank really good cloudy plum wine.
No, sorry.
Go on, what
were you saying? Well, no, I did two great ones. One with the guys at Weta have developed this sort of photogrammetry tool to digitize props. And they did a presentation on it on the first day of SIDGRAPH. But then I really wanted to find out more information and, you know, how they'd been using it and developing it. So I was able to talk to them. Also talked to the director of a film that won the jury award in the Computer Animation Festival. And that was the film's called Paths of Hay, sort of a 10-minute short film.
That is an awesome film.
It is an awesome film. And he used some relatively simple techniques in 3ds Max to do it.
Isn't that annoying, though? Isn't that kind of like really like... Because you look at a film that's that good that gets... that goes so well at the festivals, and you'd expect him to be like, well, we wrote this custom thing, which would be an excuse why I couldn't do that. Do you know what I mean? Like, I didn't have his... And he was like, no, I just used pretty much standard stuff.
Yeah, but he just, you know, it's stylized, but still has a photorealistic texture kind of feel to it. And, you know, there's a great premise to it. He saw this photo. I don't want to spoil it, but the quick story is that it's two planes dueling, basically, World War II planes. And he saw this photo of the Battle of Britain with these trails in the air, you know, of all the planes. And he thought, well, they're the last remnants of these fighter pilots. And then he drew from that. And, you know, I think a film with a great premise really works. And it doesn't matter how it was done. They're just tools that he uses. But, he won the jury award. And we've also talked to the guys who won the Best in Show award. And the film is Morris Lessmore. Great film. So those will be articles coming up on FX Guide.
And that crying you can hear in the background, that's from the guy that didn't win Best of Jury here at SIDGRAPH. Now we're actually out overlooking the water here in Vancouver. So we've actually got seaplanes landing, people walking by, photographers, paparazzi taking photos. You can hear all these clicks going on in the background that our sound engineer is going to spend a lot of time trying to get rid of.
It's a pretty cool conference center as well, isn't it? Well, I don't know if we've talked about that yet. Vancouver's beautiful and the conference center's been cool.
Yeah, but I was going to say, the other one that was really good was La Luna.
Oh, Pixar's short film, yeah. Yeah, we saw a whole presentation on that. We saw the film, and then the director, Enrico, gave a presentation on it, and afterwards... Mike, you were able to talk to him and the producer of the film as well.
Yeah, and here's a thing, which I actually kind of pride myself on researching interviews. The producer, however, was a bit of a wild card because while we'd seen the film and heard the lectures and blah, 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 we didn't actually know we were going to get lucky enough to be able to talk to the producer. So I obviously hadn't prepared for the interview because I didn't know we were going to be lucky enough to do it. And as it turns out, if you've ever watched our coverage before from SIDGRAPH, the last 2 years, so this would be the third year, we've spoken to the director of the Pixar short film of that year. So it could have been Day and Night, you know, Partly Cloudy. Well, all three of those films, including this one, were all produced by the same guy who's from casting at Pixar. So how cool is that? Like, he's really, really nice guy.
It was very cool, yeah. And so that'll be on FX Guide TV coming up in the future.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, I mean, just to your point about give me a hard time about the interview. We have,
what?
I mean, like, how many FX Guide TV apps worth of content did we get here?
Six.
I mean, that's how busy you've actually been getting stuff that you're going to see over the coming months. So it's been actually a great show.
No, I just realized that every one of the interviews, because some of these interviews I was going to do, right, but I got swapped out because of scheduling. But it just feels like, who have you talked to next, John?
Well, I think that's about it from the people that I've talked to today for our audio podcast. But hey, one thing, actually, you know what, I want to come back to something and I want to know if you've actually seen it. I've gotten a vibe, and maybe it's because we've been doing more of them at FXPHE with the new 3DS Max courses, but I'm seeing a lot of people using that now on feature. Like, you look at Pixelmondo is using it a lot, and I kind of have this, I don't know what you think, but I have this idea of it being this tool that has a lot of built-in things that you can do to what you mentioned. It's something that you buy and you can do things with it right off the bat versus, say, something like a Maya, which seems to be much more like a pipeline tool that's suited maybe to larger facilities building an external plugin.
I actually think Max has really good,
you know,
real
what I mean?
Physical light handling as well. Like,
I don't know if it's just me seeming like I'm hearing more about it or getting
actually,
the word
actually,
out.
Actually, because we're heading off to the Pixar user group in a few minutes, and that's both a function and a party. And Pixar, obviously, are really, really strong. But I've also noticed quite a lot of Arnold rendering projects
popping
up. Yeah,
right.
And
I think at the Geek Fest, that was a big request as well that seemed to be something that they would want to support for the deep compositing, right? I think they asked that question about what they want to support. I mean, there was just a question out to the audience.
Arnold isn't really released, is it, really?
Yeah.
No, sort of. It's just
almost
out there.
Released.
It's out there as open source. Yeah.
Right.
Almost
yeah.
released.
Yeah, that is it's a risky situation, I guess, potentially.
But
getting into that. But you're right. Yeah. Similarly, you're hearing a lot about it, right? And
I'm hearing a lot less about mental images this time because our good friend Zap isn't here. And if mental images want to get on the map at SIDGRAPH, they need Zap Anderson here at SIDGRAPH next year.
They got caught in the inverse release cycle or something like that this year, right? You know, without being here.
What?
Inverse release cycle. I mean, no big announcements or whatever.
No, I'm sure they had lots of big announcements.
Exactly.
Without our friend Zap here, there's no point having him, right?
Yeah, yeah.
He is like a one-man, you know, awesome machine of awesomeness.
One of the smartest men I know.
Yeah, so all I would simply say to Mental Images is, here we are. We know nothing about what happened because you didn't bother to fly your guy out to SIDGRAPH, which is a...
Although Max did also introduce iRay as a preview in one of the viewer points in 3DS Max, which is part of that, you know, but...
I just want Zap to come next year.
Me too.
The message to get to Mental Images that he needs to be flown out. You're right with the stuff. Actually, also, as I mentioned probably a couple of times now, we did that GPU panel thing earlier in the week, which was good, with Weta and ILM and Blue Sky and Sony and DNEG
as well, yeah.
Which was awesome. And if you want to hear that, the sound quality is not 100%, but we managed to run it through some filters and stuff, and we've posted the whole one-hour kind of thing unedited pretty much on FX Guide. So if you want to hear that really in-depth discussion, I've got to say the other thing is, not only is it in-depth, but they really didn't pull any punches. And not only on NVIDIA, on each other.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, even Jeff Wagner brought up some of that, because I asked him specifically about coding for the GPU and stuff, and he brought up some of the issues that they have in coding with that as well.
Well, you know,
it's not just like a huge, beautiful flowered path up into the sky with, you know,
well,
angels.
I spoke to the bakery guys about their relighting thing, and they really hard against the GPU. Mm. And so it was so funny because he was like, "And we don't do the GPU, and it's on the CPU because we need to get the blah, 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 blah." And before I'd even said a word, he said, "But actually, we're starting to look at the GPU now." Because their guys are getting like 10, 20, 100 times performance.
Yeah.
This is killing Moore's Law.
Yeah, you can actually see it really drastically and dramatically outpacing CPU.
But not without effort. Like, you can't just whack a linear algorithm into a parallel processor
so
and expect to get, like, the performance. But that also means that to get really good performance, you need good engineers. And there's kind of a level of, you know, like, you can just throw more processors at a problem when you've got linear. But when you've got parallel, to get really good performance, you need to sort of engineer it better.
Yeah, yeah. But again, and exactly as Jeff Wagner said earlier, it kind of worked to their favor in delivering these performance optimizations in Houdini, because now they've kind of hit a critical mass with the quality of the GPU, the quality of the interfaces to program for the GPU. It's really good timing for them to actually develop. So the fact that maybe they're a little bit behind in optimizing their performance actually worked better for them from a technological standpoint. So anyway, GPU stuff was interesting. And frankly, you did a very nice job sharing that.
Thanks, man.
Sharing that discussion.
This SitGraph still has like about a day to run, but turning our attention forward, we've got two big conferences still left in the year. We've got IBC, which we're hoping that you're going to go for. I'm probably not, and we know Jeff is.
Right.
So we're sorry Jeff isn't here, but he'll be doing IBC. And then you and I are both heading to SitGraph Asia at Hong Kong, which is, I think, you know, bizarrely only, you know, a few months behind SitGraph here, but it is a very good conference, and we went to the one in Korea and thought it was well worth our time. And because it is a bit smaller, this one, I guess, is smaller than LA, but this one didn't feel as small as New Orleans here.
I'm with you on that.
Yeah. But definitely Hong Kong and Singapore and, you know, what, Korea and stuff were smaller than normal SitGraph, but still remarkably good, and we really enjoyed that last time, didn't we?
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, much more approachable. They do have some new presentations there. It's certainly not just a rehash and a remix of everything here. So if you've been here and you came over from Asia, it makes sense to go there. But I think we're going to see more of that with the market in Asia just kind of blowing up and expanding. You know, the facilities in Singapore, for instance, it's got to be much easier to get over there.
But riddle me this. It
in
doesn't
India.
Feel like China, does it, if you're going to Hong Kong?
I've never been.
It's like... Yeah, I just don't think I'm going to China. Because I guess I went to Hong Kong several times when it was England.
Can you still get nice suits there?
I think so, yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Good food. But really, no, I'm looking forward to doing that later in the year. We should do a meetup and see how many people...
We should do a meetup there, but also, of course, IBC, which is a, you know, classic, brilliant time to pick up what's going on in Europe.
Yeah, it is. And like I said, Mike said, hopefully we're definitely going to have coverage from there for sure.
Do you reckon you'd say that IBC is their NAB? Because FMX is really their SitGraph, right?
I would definitely say IBC is their NAB without a doubt. The thing about FMX is, I mean, I guess I've just been a fan of theirs over the years, and after visiting this year, become more so. But there are several little smaller festivals like that, I think, in Europe. There's one in Italy.
Called View.
Yeah.
And there's even one coming up.
Simograph ones, too, as well.
I mean, Annecy is the thing that America doesn't have, right? The big animation festival Annecy is definitively...
And even in talking, it's interesting, I'm not sure, it's just centuries old. State lines and stuff, but it seems that even though, I mean, obviously Europe is a very tight, you know, tight geographic space, but it seems like that's why they still have individual shows in a lot of the countries, you know, like some of the shows in Italy, maybe a lot of people from Germany won't come, but they will go to FMX. So it seems very, you know, country specific in a lot of ways, even though many of them are in English, it still ends up being that way as far as visitors.
Well, look, to finish up the show, I think we should get serious and discuss the topic, obviously, the elephant in the room, as it were. This year's teacup, what do we think? Pixar teacup this year, it's got a hat on it. It's got little, like, goggles and a helmet. It's obviously Cars 2-esque. How do you rate it, John?
Mine is still sealed in plastic.
You must have seen it, though.
No, I actually haven't. Oh, yeah, you did show me a picture. I haven't seen it in person. You know, I can't comment on it. No, I am looking forward to the special exclusive at the
users
group meeting tonight,
I think we kind of need to go, otherwise we're going to miss out on our teapots.
Yeah, exactly. But anyway, it's been, as always, great hanging with you guys at the show. Really great experience, as we mentioned a lot of times. Really thanks to everyone coming up to us and saying hi. We appreciate it a lot.
So thank you, Ian, for all your work in organizing stuff and doing interviews. And thank you, Matt, who is not got a microphone, but is here waving, who's been doing sort of editing into the wee hours of the morning to get stuff out.
Yes, a effort.
It may look like it's easy to get stuff out from NAB or from SitGraph or wherever, but the trouble is we go all day, then we normally have functions in the evening, and it's like 11 o'clock before we actually start putting the stuff together to get out for the next morning. So the teamwork, really, really long hours. So thanks.
Thanks,
Ian. No worries. It's been great.
We'll see you at our next conference.
FX Guide is proudly sponsored by SitGraph Asia. FX Podcast is the official podcast of SIGGRAPH Asia, this year being held in Hong Kong, December 12th to 15th. For more information, go to siggraph.org/Asia2011.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.